is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
It's time to finish what I started.
How are you going to do that?
You ready?
Boils and ghouls, lock your doors and strap yourselves in. From Los Angeles, California, Bloody Disgusting presents the Boo Crew Podcast. Horror news, commentary, reviews, interviews, and more. With your hosts, Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio.
Hello, what's going on? I'm Trevor, and on behalf of myself, Lauren and Leo, welcome to the Boo Crew Podcast, episode 282. This time around, you are joined by multi-award-winning actor and director Darby Stanchfield, one of the stars of Netflix's extraordinary Lock and Key. At time of release, hear all about the fun and mystery that awaits you in season two as the series continues to lean into its awesome horror undertones and darkness. Explore the astonishing Key House, a behind-the-scenes look at the magic behind the effects, and get excited for the newly announced season three filmed back-to-back. Get to know the incredible person behind Nina Locke and the journey of bringing her to life with the support of a truly special cast that makes this show so unique and whimsical. We love it. That house is just, oh my God, we want to live there right now. You're about to turn the key to unlock episode 282 with Darby Stanchfield right now.
My husband died last year, and I moved my kids to the house where he grew up. The kids, they are doing great. But I can't move on from things that still make no sense to me. You would tell me, wouldn't you, if there was something going on?
Just because we figured out a few of the keys, we think we know everything.
We don't know everything, but we know that Dodge is gone.
Why would you turn into someone like Gabe?
Because no one's gonna suspect him of being anything more than a nerdy little kid who's fallen in love with Kinsey. Do you understand? Good.
Go ahead, scream. That's all we need.
Another victim crawls onto the gurney for a Boo Crew autopsy.
Joining Bloody Disgusting's Boo Crew via the Speakeasy Studio is an exceptionally talented actor whose work is a cavalcade of the most evocative stories ever told in TV and film. Appearing in Ryan Murphy's Emmy-winning Nip Tuck, 24, Without a Trace, Bones. Remarkable characters in projects that have really continued to evolve televised narrative. She's taken up residency in one of the world's most popular soap operas in General Hospital, CBS's Jericho, and was a part of the cast of the 16-time Emmy-winning classic Mad Men, as well as TV's most watched scripted original series, Burn Notice. Her film work has been equally inspired. Indie Sundance Smash's Waitress and Mickey Keating's wonderful horror thriller, Carnage Park, among them. In 2017, she made her directorial debut with the six-part digital series, Gladiator. Creator Wanted, and also stepped behind the camera for an episode of Scandal, the 35-time award-winning drama that she starred in for seven seasons that changed TV forever, daring to explore the subject of political power in America with a skeptic tone that spread into everything that's been seen after it and invented things like live cast tweeting and more. Then came Netflix's Lock and Key, based on the astounding comic book series created by Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez. It is full of whimsy, family, mystery, magic, and a tangible darkness that makes it an incredibly unique journey that continues to spark all of our imaginations. Its second season just debuted. She plays a matriarch of the family, Nina Locke. We are honored to welcome the fascinating Darby Stanchfield.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to let you know, I've listened to a bunch of your introductions.
Oh, wow.
For talent, and you never disappoint. That was right up there. I mean, I can't wait to meet this person.
That is so kind. Wow. Well, hey, thank you for taking some time out of your insane schedule to hang with us for a bit. And it is truly exciting to meet you. And congrats on season two as we barrel towards even more adventures in season three, which we've heard, which is amazing news all around.
Wrapped already.
Yeah, right. That's insane. All right. Season two really leans into the horror elements of the story.
Yeah. It does.
Which is also, it's really fun as parents who are horror fans, because our kids who watched the first season with us right? Their palates have kind of grown along with the show. So, right? They're ready to take it. Yeah, exactly. So rewinding it back to the beginning for you, what was the kind of gateway horror experiences that you had as a kid growing up as a viewer?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm a big scaredy cat. So I'm, you know, listen, when I was a little kid, I saw the Nightmare on Elm Street movies with Freddy Krueger, and I get out of bed for months. At night, you know, I'd have to go to the bathroom. I couldn't put my feet on the ground. Freddy Krueger lived under my bed with those knives, and he was going to cut my feet off. So, that scared me so bad. I've been like pretty light since. I will tend more towards the psychological thriller. In fact, the movie, the horror film I was in, Carnage Park, that went to Sundance, I've never seen it.
Are you serious?
No.
I read the script, and I'm a friend with one of the producers, and he offered me a role, and he said, yeah, great, cool, but I don't know that I'll watch the film.
Yeah. Wow. I was going to ask, because that's all like the Glass Eye Picks people. Those are indie horror royalty, like Larry Fessenden and Pat Healy and Mickey Keating, all those people. That's hilarious. Well, that said, what do you like about performing in that space, though?
Oh, well, it's Lock and Key is a special one. And I mean, Carnage Park was just fun. We shot, you know, out in the desert in California, and there are a bunch of great guys, Mickey Keating and Eric Fleischman. And that was just a ball of fun. I mean, I have a giant imagination, so, you know, the circumstances are always heightened. So it's just gritty and fun to get into. I think I was covered in blood at one point in that film. So, you know, what's not to love there? But with Lock and Key, it's, you know, it's definitely, season one was more fantastical. It's more of a fantasy magic, very, very light on the horror, as you, I'm sure, are aware. Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez, their graphic novels are heavy horror, and they're beautifully illustrated and told. And when Netflix did this Lock and Key, they started off the tone quite a bit back from that. So it did build into season two. You know, the kids get older and they're more savvy with these magical keys and the powers that they hold. And so the evil forces, the demons, are a little more insidious. And, you know, it just all sort of explodes into like, you know, it's dialed up to 11.
What made you originally, just signing on to it, what made you passionate about the story? And then moving forward, the cast, and how has that affected you not only as a performer, but as a person?
Initially, I just really liked the story of this family, and I like how it's a very unique world, Lock and Key, and that it's, you know, it's like about this ordinary family, but they confront this, you know, when they move to Massachusetts to try to get over their father's death, you know, my husband's death. They encounter Key House, his ancestral home, and the world of the magic in this house. And I like the opposition of the very ordinary, normal family that's not savvy to any of these elements, this magic, that there's like a whole universe that they don't know. So I like the juxtaposition of that. I also like that there's an adult storyline, and then there's storyline with the, you know, the YA, the kids in school. So that was cool as well. It was just such a unique world, and I've always wanted to be in a show that was very sort of fantasy driven, that had a touch of horror. Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, all those movies and shows, you know, it was just sort of like on my checklist. So the genre was fun. And then moving on to the cast, It's an extraordinary cast. I mean, it's just a good group of human beings. I truly enjoy working with all of them. Some of them I work with more than others, obviously, but the three actors who play the Locke kids, they're just fantastic human beings. And we found a really natural family chemistry. And, you know, it was just, I feel really lucky. You know, it was just one of those experiences that has been a joy to go to work every day. It's not always that way, but this one, you know, no politics, no divas, no, just everybody was there to have fun. And I think the other thing that always struck me since season one is that all of the actors, and I could say for the writers and the creators as well, but the actors like showed up to play. There wasn't any, like they fully committed. And even the, you know, I was curious about like the younger actors on the show, like, would they be sort of skeptical and eye rolling and on their phones? And they went for it. And they did their best. They dove into the, you know, the imaginary circumstances and were, you know, they just were as believable as they could be. And I loved playing with a bunch of people who had that level of commitment.
Yeah, you sense that. Everything kind of is lit on fire when you watch this as a viewer. And it gives it like an extraordinarily unique and intimate feeling that it's really hard to put a finger on. But you get this warm sense from everything. And saying that, having filmed a third season now.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit about just the alchemy that grows between characters when you get to spend 30 or so hours wearing them? And that's just in our eyes, infinitely more in yours, in the production process, how that gets imbued into the emotional process of these characters.
Well, I think the thing that was really unique about shooting season 2 and 3, we shot them back to back. Netflix, you know, they ordered the first season, 10 episodes straight to, you know, they greenlit 10 episodes. And before, they had aired for a month on Netflix, and Netflix immediately ordered a season 2. And before they even saw any footage of season 2, they ordered a season 3. So, and you know, coming from Netflix, they're not sentimental about shows. They like cancel them if their numbers aren't happening. So, we got to shoot 2 seasons back to back. We had a 2-week hiatus between the 2 seasons. So it was really a year. We shot a year of Lock and Key in Toronto and during a pandemic. That's what the unusual part was. In Canada, it was really way more locked down, I'd say, than the US. You know, I was getting, lots of news from home, from LA, that everything had opened up and everybody had gotten their vaccines. And although that happened in Canada as well, it happened months later. So we were really, really in a lockdown. We were quarantining. Our cast, our production was in a bubble.
So everything is even more intimate and close than ever before.
There's this feeling like we were just all together all the time. And also, you know, with the hours, I mean, because of the pandemic, we shot French hours, 10 and a half hour days. Sometimes it would turn into 11 or 12, but you know, it was a little less than maybe before, but really they were the only people that my co-stars are the only people I saw when I was there. There was no going out. There's no going outside the bubble. There's nothing open. And it was also freezing half the time, the weather. So you couldn't even go outside for a walk half the time because it was frigid in the fall and winter last year in Toronto. So there was a familiarity. There was an intimacy that you get working with actors that intensely, you know, that many hours, that many days. And when people start to get home, like one thing I think I feel like I bonded with these kids with the especially the Locke kids is like, you know, they had, some of them had parents there, but some of them didn't have all their parents, or they didn't have a sister. One of them, you know, didn't have their partner there. My husband, I didn't see him all year. I saw him for 5 weeks out of the whole year.
Wow. Oh my God.
So we all sort of bonded over this sort of homesickness for our families. There were some ways that we connected that, you know, had very much to do with the pandemic and how everybody deals in those isolated situations too. I think some people do puzzles, some people drink, some people, you know, have dance parties. And when we all sort of dealt with it a little bit differently and then we come together, we make this show. And I know for me personally, I needed this creative process during this time, and I felt really emotionally connected to Nina Locke and this world. It was like I needed to go to work and I needed to connect with these people because it's really all I had. It's crazy how when I was sort of, you know, put in an isolated situation and away from my home and my own loved ones, how it just almost intensified the need to have a creative outlet and to put that energy somewhere. So, you know, I'll never forget this last year. It was a really special time. I think some really good work came out of it. Season three is crazy. I can't say anything about it, but it carried on from season two. I mean, it only builds. It must be fun watching it with kids. You said you watched it with your kids. How old are your kids?
We got four kids. Yeah. Raging the gamut. Yeah, raging the gamut in ages, for sure. Like our
okay,
eldest.
I'm going to test you.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I knew this was coming.
All right, how old are they?
All right, the youngest one, Thayer, is four.
Okay.
Then we got Jade, who is born on Halloween.
She just had a birthday.
Seven.
Yes.
Yeah. We've got Everett, who's nine.
Yes.
And we got Scarlett, who is in grade seven.
So that's...
She's 12.
12.
12. Yes. So that's a wide range.
You have a wide range, and that's how this show is. You know, you got a little one,
exactly.
And you have like older kids, and then you have the parents. So it's like a good show for a family because there's something for everybody.
Exactly. No, totally true. So again, going back to not to harp on the pandemic, but it's really interesting how that it's coming out in the show as well, is like, it must have been interesting going from a real world full of chaos to be able to construct this world in a bubble where everything is okay in the sense. The pandemic doesn't exist. It's got its own, you know, rules and problems.
There's a serenity there. Totally. I mean, I think the actors, I think the production felt really safe. You know, we didn't shut down once. We're one of the only productions in the business that didn't shut down. There were flare-ups, you know, and it's just a testament to how committed everybody was. I mean, there were so many of our crew members that I spoke to over the Canadian Thanksgiving, which is in like October. How was your Thanksgiving? I asked. And, you know, so many of them were like, oh, I didn't see my parents, or, you know, my boyfriend and I stayed in, or, you know, I was alone. I mean, everybody really did bubble. And I think that's why we're able to successfully keep shooting. And so what it did is it created a really safe feeling environment. I mean, you know, it felt like we were running the production like a surgeon's room, because everybody, the crew, there were PPE and shields, and anybody who touches us or touches props, they're in robes and gloves. And then there's this little world of like the Locke family and Matheson High, you know, and the demons, and we're all running around like nothing's going on. But behind the scenes, you know, everybody's really shielded up. But it, you know, we obviously tested a million times a week. So you know, whether it was like a love scene or a fight scene, you felt like you could just, okay, everybody's done their thing. You know, we're washing our hands, you know, and there was a freedom, I think, in getting to sort of, as an actor, I mean, I felt very privileged that I could come to work and take my mask off, because most of the crew and the writers and the director, even, you know, shield mask, that's tough to work in all those hours. So, but they made it safe for us, and we were able to just, yeah, pretend like there wasn't.
Exactly. Playing your imagination, right? Even more so than ever before.
What I love about Nina Locke is she's not this perfect mom. And many times I feel the pressure to be a perfect mom. And I'm definitely not. I'm like burning things left and right, spilling things, right, forgetting about conferences, which I have to sign up for one.
You know how old your kids are.
I do. So. I do. And I know their birthday.
And so do I. And I proved it. So.
What do you love about Nina and how she's written and what you get to bring to life?
Exactly what you said. I love that she is not this perfect mom. I mean, what I was interested in, what I really wanted to create with the beautiful writing and the story, was a sense of her realness and that she was flawed, and that she has a good, I love that she's got this good heart. She, of course, she puts her kids first. That's the most important thing. But she's just confronting being a single parent after her husband's murdered. And I also love that she is, you know, in the graphic novel, she's drinks the whole time. She's inebriate. She's an alcoholic. But in our show, she's a recovering alcoholic. So she's trying to stay sober through the hardest time of her life. And some of her, you know, some of her sobriety and the path to that, she had Rendell to sort of champion her along, and he's gone and she's got to do it all on her own. And that, I love that that was established in season one when she does fall off the wagon and start drinking. But then she, it continues in season two. They don't just drop it. Like, it's something that continues on. I like the integrity of that, that it's like a continuation of this character. I got to play that the whole time. And, you know, she's burning toast and all sorts of breakfast things in the first season. And you see her sort of progress, but you also see her struggle. I like that she, I love her heart, and I like that she gets it right, and then she doesn't get it right, and she's pretty truthful with herself about it. Moms are underrated to play. I think she's very, very interesting mother to play. I would do it again. I mean, it's just really rich, creative space.
As you can see behind us, the aesthetic of Lock and Key is right up our alley.
It looks like, yeah.
Right? Yes. Yeah. I mean, man, when we saw the very first episode, we were like, oh my God, this is home. This show is home for us.
The Boo Crew will be right back.
We interrupt this program to bring you the following special announcement. The world's first horror head transplant has failed, and five brain donors have died in the experiment. Now you can see it all at your local theater in Beast of Blood. And on the same show, Curse of the Vampires, both brand new in gory color. You'll see a mad fiend transplant human heads in the Cave of Horrors and encounter stunning, screaming, shocking terror as it lives. A monster's head detached from its body, causing savage and inhuman destruction. More fantastic than science, more shocking than fantasy, the creature without a head, controlled by an insane artificial brain. Beast of Blood. Don't miss Beast of Blood and Curse of the Vampires, both rated GP.
We got to ask you just about the aesthetic of walking into that set and all that goes into it. How much of what we are seeing is really there? Is it? I'm assuming the exterior is kind of a shell and the interior is all built on a set. Does it stay up? What is it like to be there?
It is massive. Key House takes up two entire stages of some production stages in Toronto. And so just the kitchen alone, I mean, we went into, when we first shot the pilot, we went in there with the director, Michael Morris, and I think Carlton Cuse was there as well. And we walked the first floor of Key House, which is in this one entire set. And we were all, it's great because it's the first time, we just rehearsed the first time that we see Key House, and then we shot it right after we saw it.
Oh, so that's
really
amazing.
Fun. Had this, we were all just like, are you kidding me? It's massive. And my prep work before, I have to tell you something funny, my prep work before we started shooting, before I had seen the space, I had all of these choices that I had sort of written in the margins of like when I might touch a child or when I might, you know, just to have this sort of, I wanted a language of watching some mothers that I was modeling this after and how their body language is with their kid, their kids. And I really wanted to have that. And as soon as I saw Key House and we were going to shoot a scene in the kitchen of Key House, which is massive. I mean, the kitchen table is like something out of Game of Thrones. It seats like 40 people. I was like, oh, I'm not touching one child. They're going to be on one end of the kitchen and I'm going to be over by the stove. I mean, there's no sort of you know, Key House is a character of its own.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a formidable presence. And the detail, I wish you could see, there are KH for Key House carved into doorknobs and on the wood trims. There's stained glass windows that have dark little details of like a sailor falling out of the ship into the water. I mean, tiny details that the camera might never see, but we layers and layers and layers. There's wallpaper, there's tiles on the floor. They all have little keys in them. And then the exterior, it's like you said, it's a shell. And there are two levels that are built. And then if you've ever seen a behind the scenes picture of Lock and Key, you'll see there's a green strip at the top because they green screen a third floor and then a turret at the top. But the first two floors are massive. We took a picture of the cast after we wrapped season three, near the end of season three. We took a whole company picture out at Key House, at the exterior. There's like 200 people and we're like ants in this. I mean, it's crazy how enormous it is.
It's so interesting to hear you say that you almost had to like kind of retrain or adapt your performance to the actual structure itself. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it really, really did inform. And with the action, I mean, it is a full athletic kind of experience as an actor, tearing through the hallways, especially for the kids. Listen, when they're doing all of these magic sequences, whether they're running from a giant spider or, you know, or battling with Dodge with the lightsabers, these hallways and these rooms are massive. So everybody's getting a workout. it's giant.
The prop department on the show continues to amaze in season two, and we get to see the spectacular dollhouse version of Key House.
Yes.
And all these new keys. So tell us just about, for anyone who's on the fence or who's about to dive into season two, just some of the creations and keys that we'll get to wonder at as an audience together in season two.
Well, in season two, you mentioned it. There is a doll size. I mean, it's a giant doll size house, but there's a doll size house replica of Key House that is actually owned by Nina Locke, my character's new love interest. He has this dollhouse and his daughter, who's Bodhi's age, you know, she and Bodhi sort of start to investigate it and he ends up finding a little key and it's the small world key. And they realize that it goes to this house and there's a keyhole and they use it in the dollhouse and it comes to life. And so they can actually open the roof and look into Key House and actually see the Locke family members in there, and they can put things in there. They can take things out. There's all sorts of chaos that can happen. And for a while, only those two know about it. And, you know, they're quite little on the show and mischievous. And and I will say, you know, to go along with that storyline, the special effects crew department on our show, they're astonishing. I mean, they're given a really nice budget, but they really come through. So when you see a tiny little spider crawl into this dollhouse and then cut to real life Key House and the spider is, you know, the size of the skylight above the window, it's astonishing. It's really great stuff. Cinematic. Beautiful.
Those keys are so incredible. Just the design of all of them. Did they let you keep?
Yeah, a jeweler, they had a jeweler make these keys. You know, wow. I mean, Gabriel Rodriguez, he designed these keys for the comic book series. He illustrated them and we kept our show kept really, really close. You know, we kept it the same. We used his designs, but they're really expensive. They only would make a few. I mean, had to make more than one just in case it got lost. But yes, I got to take a key. It's a key I can't say. Haven't seen it yet. Three key. There are new keys in season three as well. But I think the showrunners, I think Carlton Cuse and Meredith Avril have the most keys. I think they took like a handful. No, they're amazing. They're like jewelry. Let me tell you, season one, I had key envy. I think I only got to like, when Nina gets drunk, she gets the mending key. But I was just like, I want to give it back.
Oh my gosh. I want that ghost key.
Yeah, the ghost key is really, really cool.
So cool.
And on season two, you get to play with the head key.
Yes.
How is that? How do they do that effect?
So they have the head key with the key part on the end. And then for special effects, they also made a replica of the key, but it's just like half the size of the key. So you just see the head with the little stem. And then what happens is, you know, anything with magic or with special effects, it just takes hours and hours to shoot. So we have to shoot a version where one puts the real key back there. So you can see that motion. But when they do the close-up, you take the smaller key and the makeup department puts a little, like glues a little, it's almost like a plug, but it's just like a little thing that will hold the key. And then that shorter key goes in there. So it looks like a key is sticking in your neck.
Oh, that's cool. That's so cool. And then, so
there's very specific acting about turning it a quarter turn, a certain counterclockwise. I had to learn all that, of course, you know, once I got to use that key. But yeah, it's pretty cool the way they do that. And then they sort of match that. And then, you know, when you're in your head, you see there's a second one of your character that appears. So you're playing all of those. It's fun.
I love that there's a method to, you got to turn it a certain way. And so it's like when I worked at Dairy Queen, you have to do the curl a certain way.
Same thing.
How did they, not to harp on effects, but the effects in the show are so good, but going back to season one and the mirror dimension, was a mirror dimension a practical effect?
Okay, first of all, you should talk to Connor Jessup, who plays Tyler in it, who saves Nina out of the mirror. We spent weeks in this mirror sequence. We spent time there were a lot of special effects, but there were also just a lot of different mirror setups. They built a hallway of mirrors that were like a two-way mirror where you could see through it. But so so a long hallway with green screens on either end that we would walk through. There was the octagon shaped mirror dome that was made. I'm trying to remember. I think it's spun. No. We spun. But so we would get put into this octagon shaped mirror dome thing. The cameras are on the outside shooting into it. And there was another one. There was like another sort of cage type thing that we did. But it was really fascinating because when you're in these mirror sequences, you don't have any depth. You know, it's all, you just see yourself, like a million of yourself. So you get seasick.
Yeah, right.
Like I would actually have to focus on the ground between takes to get my bearings because you lose all sense of
like equilibrium or whatever, right? Yeah.
It's really weird. Yeah. I felt like it was like a psychological test they were doing on us to see if we could really, you know, if we were really up for the show.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I can't imagine reading the script and trying to figure out in my head what that's going to look like when it's done.
Yeah. Right.
No, that was something that's a good point. Like, and that carried all the way through all three seasons that we've shot. You know, we don't know what these things are going to look like. And what's so great is the director will get like a mock-up made, like, you know, they'll have pre-production meetings with special effects and with the showrunners, and they all come up with, you know, a mock-up of what they want it to look like once it's gone through post. So they'll show us a video typically when we're rehearsing and say, this is sort of the idea, or they'll show storyboards, but you're not reacting to anything. You know, there's a green screen or there's like a million mirrors and you don't ever really know. So, reminds me of theater in that way, and that you know, there's a sort of fourth wall that you don't, you're imagining it and you're green screen. It's like it's like theater, you know, you're sort of reacting off nothing.
It's the best show ever. How about you as a director yourself, who's directed projects and a really kind of integral episode of Scandal that you directed as well. What would be your feelings of directing an episode of Lock and Key?
Well, I thought about it. I never asked to direct. I didn't have a meeting with the showrunners about it because I really wanted to just focus on acting.
Sure.
From the beginning, from season one, I had a real gut instinct about that, about really wanting to just wear one hat and really. Yeah, I think too, we didn't know what the world was. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, I don't know if you know, but Lock and Key had been made into a pilot two other times. This was the third.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was in development. So they had really, really specific notes on what wasn't working or what they wanted to do this time. And I think just as coming on a new genre and a new show and a new and really establishing a world that we really needed to get right this time, I thought, you know, maybe if there were season 4, 5, 6, 7, I would go into it, but it felt really nice. And then quite honestly, when the pandemic hit, I just, and with all of the precautions that we had to take as actors, I just didn't want to, you know, that just would give me more exposure, you know, unnecessarily on set. So I was happy to make that choice, but you know, to direct something like Lock and Key, I mean, it's like a movie. It's, you know, it's just, and our directors did such a nice job. You know, it's just so, such a big look, isn't it? You know, all of the sequences and the beautiful camera moves and the cinematic feel of Key House and the intimate moments with the family. It's got everything.
I wanted to ask you about the, and you mentioned it earlier, about the integration of this new character, Josh Bennett, who we see, and
yes,
what he awakens in Nina and what you enjoyed about that.
I like this storyline for Nina. It was really interesting to sort of negotiate or navigate grief and then meeting someone new and the timing of that. And one thing I especially that was helpful and that I especially liked with that storyline is that he had lost his wife to a sudden death as well. So there was a shared grief that they had, and it was okay for, you know, it wasn't like Nina meets this guy and then she forgets about Rendell. It's very much like they're able to meet each other in their grief and accept each other for it and connect over it. I think that's so much more interesting than, you know, okay, one's over and one's begun. It's messier. It's more realistic.
Yeah, he comes in hot. That for when we first see him, I don't know if I like him when I first see him.
it's and he's great. Brendan Hines, he's a great actor. He makes me laugh. I had worked with him on Scandal before. He was another character's love interest. And by the time my character interacts with him, he's dead. And I roll him up in a rug. We're cleaning up the, you know, cleaning up the evidence. And so it was fun to, you know, actually get to be alive and say some words together.
There's so many poignant takeaways from the story of Lock and Key. There's the power of family. There's retaining and nurturing the magic and curiosity of childhood really being at its heart for us. What impact has the story left on you?
There is something really, I've thought about this a lot as we've worked on these seasons, whether it's magic or it's, even if that's like a, you know, like a symbol for something like this, like this openness to other possibilities. I love that. And that totally speaks to the child in each of us. Actually chokes me up a bit. And I think that's why I like genres like this, because it's like, life can be so incredibly ordinary and limiting feeling. You know, when we get to be adults and we're paying mortgages and we're, you know, you're doing all the, you know, and so the idea of magic or there being something in outer space or, you know, that there's such thing as a miracle. I mean, these these possibilities are just fun to entertain, and they sometimes can, you know, obviously in Lock and Key, they lead to a bunch of danger, but there's also some beauty in it as well. And it really does speak to that sort of childlike play that we each have. And I think during to the pandemic, I was reminded of that as well, just in my own challenges of being, you know, suddenly having to, like we all did, stay at home and isolate, you know, wanting to be more creative and wanting to be more sort of going back to my childhood in a way of like finding happiness or finding joy or finding possibility in a really dark time, in a scary time that we all don't know as a, you know, as a race, as a humanity that we're sort of navigating through. And so magic in sometimes can be like comforting, the escape, or the possibility can be comforting. I'm kind of rambling, but
no, I mean, it's a completely. Yeah. I mean, it really, through the pandemic, I think it really helped people elevate or kind of magnify what's really important, you know,
yeah,
being the magic and love and family and all those things, you know, and I think is all stuff that's imbued into the heart of the story of Lock and Key. So it kind of goes hand in hand, I think.
Yeah. Something our creators, Meredith Averill and Carlton Q, said at the very beginning of this, we did a table read at the pilot. And one of the things they have said that I'll never forget is, at the heart of this show, it's magic, it's fantasy, it's, you know, there's going to be scary horror, but at the center of it is this family. And there's a heart to this show. So you said it, you know, you don't lose sight that that's there as well as all the other. And I love that about the show. Mm-hmm. Special.
As do we.
Definitely.
So moving forward, what are you working on right now? What irons are in the fire for you?
The irons in the fire is being home right now.
That's great.
Like I said, I hadn't seen my husband for more than 5 weeks in a year, and I am enjoying
life. Yeah.
Being friends, family, life, being in the same city as well as, you know, the same house, and, you know, enjoying meals together and that sort of thing. So I'm enjoying some time off, and I hope to keep it that way for a little while. It was quite a year.
Do you have any like ritual that you do to watch the show? Do you sit around and go through episode by episode? Do you binge it? Do you stay away from it? What do you do at this point?
For Lock and Key, for both the first and the second season, I was given access to it early, simply because for both seasons I did a pretty heavy amount of press right when it launches. And so I was able to, you know, get an early look at the final product. So as I went and publicized the show, talk about the show, I sort of know what, you know, what they went with editing wise and sort of how it turned out, the tone. And both times I watched it like pretty quickly, in like a couple of nights, not one sitting, but you know, 2-3 nights. By myself, except my husband could join, but I wouldn't let him really. I was like, "Let's don't say hello. Let's just kind of watch it and talk after." I just wanted to, and then after, it's like, you know, I have family and friends who like want to watch stuff together, and that's great. But I wanted one first look to just really take in everybody's work and the all of the work that goes into it, you know. It's such a collaborative effort. It's fun to really get to see everybody's touch on it. And so I try to do one pass at it, just really not live tweeting.
Just kind of consuming it. Yeah. Do you miss not having that in your life at this moment in that way?
Yeah. It's just kind of hit me that we're like, it seems like every time in the last year that I've seen my husband, it's for like a week or two, and then I'm going back. And so I think I've been here now a few weeks, and it's just hitting me that we're done for a bit, or who knows how long. And I love this job. I love these actors. I'd be lying if I didn't say that I didn't miss it. I miss it. I mean, I just love that world and this job. And all three seasons were just so strong and such positive experience for me. And I think everybody, but it's not, I'm grateful. I'm just grateful for what we've done so far. And I miss it, but not in like a all consumed, you know, I just think fondly of it.
Yeah.
I miss the set and I've never even been there. I want like to sign, like start a petition that like whenever it's done filming, like they let people go into the sets.
I know. I was so happy after season one. I found out like kind of secretively, you know, through the top secret, you know, executive producer chain that they were not taking down Key House and the stages after season one. And we hadn't officially gotten picked up for season two, but I was like, come on, this is a good chance that we're going to get picked up, because and it's taking up the entire building. So if they're not taking it down, you know, I don't know what's going on with it right now, but I am with you. Tours.
Yes, I'll house it.
Oh, it'd be amazing.
Well, I'll move the kids out there.
Oh. All right, well, Darby, thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. I know we've gone over. We just love talking to you so much. It's been an absolute delight, and we cannot wait to see what season 3 has in store for us, and beyond that, and to talk to you again once you're able to discuss season 3 in more detail. We are really looking forward to it, and again, thank you so much for hanging out with us and spending time with us.
Sure, thank you. It's been fun.
That was the Boo Crew Podcast, episode 282. Special thanks to our guest, Darby Stanchfield. Follow her at Darby S Official on Instagram. The time of release, season 2 of Lock and Key, is available on Netflix now. Production tracks provided by Power Man 5000. Till next time, it is the Boo Crew saying, sweet screams.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Boo Crew Podcast. Haunt the Boo Crew at TalesFromTheBooCrew.com. Tales from the Boo Crew on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on Twitter at TalesFromTheBoo. The Boo Crew is Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio. The Boo Crew is produced by Lauren Shand, chopped and sliced by Trevor Shand. The Boo Crew is a TSP creation, part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Bye.
The Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, home of the Boo Crew. Horror-centric interviews, SCP archives, weekly full cast storytelling, horror queers, genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective, and creepy. For disturbing and terrifying creepypastas. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.